Thank you for coming out in this rain. It's awesome. Thanks. I'm surprised that any of you are here. I know some of you aren't even staying at the hotel, so you didn't have to just, you know, roll out of bed and come down. So I appreciate you being here. I'm Peter Kim, Chief Strategy Officer at Dachis Group. We're going to talk about a few things and how they relate to social media. If you read the session description, you know, there's a lot of talk today about social media, you know, what it is, where it came from. I'm pretty sure that you all know what we're talking about. But how many people have read the Clutrain manifesto in here? A handful? Okay, I'll admit I've never read it. Okay, so if that destroys my credibility with you, I apologize. But I'm pretty sure I get what, you know, Searles et al. We're talking about, to be honest with you. But actually, why social media works goes back a little bit beyond there. And we're going to talk about some fundamentals here. I'm going to start off the session with a shameless plug. I finished a book called Social Business by Design, publishes May 1st. So it'll come, I'm going to warn you ahead of time, this is the first shameless plug, and it'll come back again and rear its head at the end. Has anybody authored a book in here? Anybody written a book? So you know, Carrie, for example, the effort, you know, the pain that you endure. Short URL, dach.is/sbdbook. Okay, so let's get one more thing before we get into the presentation. I need to give credit where credit is due to two people. One, Malcolm Gladwell, author. Second, Scott Monte, who's head of social media, global social media at Ford. You can tweet at either of them. Scott is more likely to respond to you than Malcolm is. And why these two guys is because Scott invited me up to Dearborn 4 or 5 months ago. And there was an event at which Gladwell was speaking. And based on inspiration from that talk, I put this whole South By conversation together. So Scott's actually going to be here next week on Tuesday with the whole Ford crew. So keep an eye out for him. All right, so who's from Austin in here? Many of you. And who flew in to Austin just for this awesome weather that we're having? Yeah, welcome to, everybody else will tell you, the others who, like, it's not, this is weird, like, it's not like this. So you come in, you know, you actually exit the airport and you get on Ben White and you drive west into the city. But if you turn right instead and you start going east, you'll end up in a little town called Bastrop. Okay, Bastrop, Texas is about 20 minutes east of the airport, and then out there is a place called the Hyatt Regency Lost Pines. And depending on your, you know, your POV, a nice retreat out there in the middle of the woods. And when you go out to Lost Pines, they've got a lot of Texan-style things for you to do. Now, thank you for, you know, many of you haven't worn your cowboy hats and your boots, you know, because a lot of people, I'm going to Texas, you know, but you know that Austin's really not like that so much. But when you go to Lost Pines, it kind of is. For example, you can ride a longhorn while you're out there. You know, they'll get up there and take your picture. You know, these guys are like, things I do for a living, man. You know, get on my back, take a picture, and, you know, get off. So, and people are very happy to get up on longhorns, just as long as you don't get anywhere near the tips of those horns. They've got things like a lazy river, which, you know, would have been really cool and tempting if the weather wasn't like it was outside today. But, you know, you get in a, you know, you get an inner tube, you get a cooler, you put your beer in that floats alongside with you. You spend all day floating on the lazy river, getting a sunburn. You know, what else? They've also got horseshoes out there, you know, Texan sort of thing, horses. And you may actually see people ride horses right down 6th Street, because that happens actually during the week as well. With the rain, probably not. But if you know the game of horseshoes, you know, you take actual horseshoes. And out at Lost Pines, they've got a horseshoe pit. Actually, they've got two horseshoe pits. And, you know, this is the kind of thing where if you play this game, you know, you stand in one section, there's a distance, and you try to ring the horseshoe around a post on the other end. Now, it's the kind of resource that doesn't make sense to have one for every guest room, for example, right? I mean, could you imagine that? Like, there's a horseshoe pit for every, with a suite upgrade, you know, and there's like 100 of them around at Lost Pines. Doesn't make any sense, right? So these are for sharing. There's a centralized location. Of course, you have to take turns if someone is on it. I think the woman in the far, the background of this picture was definitely posing or very stylistic, stylish horseshoe thrower. But the horseshoe pit is an example of communal sharing. So the first principle when we talk about understanding social media, and if you'll bear with me with the definition, With communal sharing, there's a relationship where people treat some group or some thing, some resource, as equivalent and undifferentiated with respect to social domain, right? We all use the horseshoe pit. So keep that in mind. So communal sharing, principle number one. Online, something like Wikipedia or Wikimedia Commons, right? We all, or many people, anyone who wants to can go to Wikimedia Commons, use images, put them in their presentation, just like I've done later on today. And by usage, you can see social proof or take up and contribution to Wikipedia, and the proof of communal sharing success is in the numbers, right? So we started in 2001. Roughly 7 contributors. These days, there's almost 1.5 million contributors to Wikipedia, right? So the power of communal sharing coming into play in social media. All right, element number two. So Hammurabi, right? Back in the days of Babylon, Hammurabi and Hammurabi's code. Any Latin speakers out there? No, I'm looking at Carrie. She's like Harvard educated, et cetera, right? Lex Talonis, or the I speak no Latin, so I just made that up. It might be pronounced totally different. So, but this is Hammurabi's code, better known as eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, limb for a limb. And this is actually, Hammurabi's code is in the Louvre. This is actually a sculpture showing Hammurabi dealing out and doling out the code. And it makes provisions for a lot of things, actually. It's not just punishment, which is the most popular element or the most re-communicated part of the code, but it talks about how families are, how families in Babylon were supposed to live together and to relate to one another, how commerce was supposed to be conducted, and of course, punishment. And it's not as direct as you would think, or if you know the code, you know that the penalties, for example, and it's not literally an eye for an eye. Well, if you poked somebody's eye out, then he gets to poke your eye out, right? It's not that straightforward. It was more like if you were a slave in Babylon and you did not listen to your master, then your ear would be cut off, right? So a crime befitting a punishment. Or if you were a doctor and someone, or a physician or surgeon, and someone passed away under your care, then you would have a hand cut off for not rendering good enough service, right? So thankfully, there are probably no tiger moms in Babylon to push their kids to be surgeons, because it was a really dangerous profession back then. Okay, so Hammurabi dealing some code, and this expresses a principle called equality matching, right? So a relationship where people keep track of balance among participants, and they know what's required. They keep score. And if you're married, this is actually a very bad thing to have happen, right? Equality matching. It leads to a lot of fights. So eye for an eye, equality matching. What does this look like online? As I was kicked off of my own network. Blog roles. How many people still blog in this audience, like me? We're the crazy ones, okay? Blogs are dead. No one reads blog. Why do we do it, right? It's almost out of habit, just because we do. So this is my friend Ray Wong. He's at Constellation Group now. We work together at Forrester Research. And he's got a pretty good blog if you're into enterprise architecture, enterprise IT. And something that Ray does, bless his heart, is maintains a blog role on the side of his blog. Something that happened way back in the day where people put links to other sites of people's whose blogs they read. And so I don't know if Ray really reads my blog, but you know, we're friends, so he put mine up there. And why does that matter? Because at least back in the day, the way Google rankings worked was based on authority and inbound links. So blog roles were great. You put people's links in there, they link back to you, and you both get into a better spot, right? Essentially, it's a principle of you scratch my back, I scratch yours, right? You put me on your blog role, I'll put you on mine, and we'll both get some Google juice and raise up in the rankings. So that is equality matching in play, right? So the way this Hammurabi principle, eye for an eye, comes into play. All right, so do you remember this movie? How many, Four Weddings and a Funeral? 1994, right? Craig, I work with, you're shaking your head, and most of the guys that I ask, they're like, what are you talking about, man? Four weddings and a funeral? And I'll admit, 1994, I was studying in Cambridge that summer, and I went down to London for a day trip, and it's all over the place, right? Piccadilly Square, and like, God, that is the last movie on earth I'd want to see. Like, you know, I'm in college. But it launches Hugh Grant's career, right? Four Weddings and a Funeral, huge, right? And if you know, Hugh Grant, as he rose to stardom, had a girlfriend at the time who was pretty popular herself. And not too long ago, Debenhams, the retail in London, took a poll to vote for most iconic red carpet dress ever, right? And if you know Hugh Grant, you know who's going to win this poll. But let me show you the dress that Elizabeth Hurley was made famous for. It was a Versace creation. There are different angles to this dress. I thought, you know, the word hookers in the title, you might get the wrong idea, right? So I went with a more modest picture here. But a, you know, large gold safety pin, Versace creation. And actually, after she made her appearance on the red carpet after this is when she took off and became the spokeswoman for Estee Lauder, in movies herself, et cetera. But if you, so, you know, you see Hugh, you see Liz, and it's like, you know, like, it's funny. In the green room, I was overhearing conversation amongst the people, and they're saying, well, you know, like, there are guys that are just, I mean, they hadn't seen this presentation. There's some guys that, like, people can't hate these guys. They're just good looking, you know, like Brad Pitt. You know, he's a, everybody can agree, guys and women alike, right? No, you don't get it? Not so much? All right, Johnny Depp, you know, pretty universally, yeah. George Clooney, too, you know, Harrison Ford. Like, no, okay, all the guys want to be Han Solo, you know, Harrison Ford, and all the women want, like, to date, or maybe they want him to be your godfather now or something, right? Or Calista Flockhart, are they any In Touch or People Readers, are they still together? All right. So so Hugh Grant. So look at this, like, you know, good looking couple. So Hugh Grant goes out, if you know, and in LA decides to basically, you know, really put roll the dice on his fortune. He meets a woman named Divine Brown. And what happens is that he ends up in this situation. Now, how did he get here? How did Hugh Grant get here? Well, see, he met Divine, or he, you know, propositioned Divine Brown, and the service that he wanted from her, she said, well, I can give you that, and it'll cost you $100, because he wanted to have the service performed back in a hotel. And he said, well, look, I only got 60 bucks. And I mean, you know, it's like, it's funny, ironic, right? The way you and I roll, like, you probably have more than 60 bucks in your pocket right now, but like, Hugh Grant, dude, come on. Like, how can you not? Anyway, all he had was 60 bucks. So she said, that's cool. Like, we'll go to a dark corner of the park and we'll make it happen, right? That is our value exchange here. Well, in the police report, the way the cops wrote it up and said, well, something caught our attention, which was the shining of a brake light. Because as the service is being delivered, Mr. Grant is pushing on the brake pedal while they're parked, which, of course, in the darkness, policemen are like, what's going on? Or like, why's someone pumping the brake pedal? And then, of course, that's what happens. I'm like, God, Hugh, if you had $40 more, you could have avoided all the shit, right? So unfortunately, that's what happened, right? So Hugh, but if you know, the story's not all bad. Notting Hill? Okay, so movies came after that, and Hugh, you know, came back, but he and Liz were no more, and maybe for the best, right? It was maybe a little bit longer than Chris Humphrey's Kim Kardashian marriage, right? So what this demonstrates is market pricing. So in this case, relationships oriented to socially meaningful ratios. Of course, very directly in this case, exchanging sex or an act for money. In this case, $60 for one particular service. But market pricing isn't always about money. So if you think about this, there's a quote from a friend, Doug Rushkoff, and from CNN. On Facebook, as the S-1 was filed, Doug was quoted as saying, well, we're not the customers, we're the product. Now think about that for a second if you haven't yet contemplated what this means. On Facebook, users don't pay, you know, no one paid. If someone, that's like selling someone the Brooklyn Bridge, right? Look, dude, pay me 20 bucks and I'll get you on Facebook, right? No one does that. You get on Facebook for free. So what you give to them is your time and your personal data. What you get from Facebook is a tool for communicating with other users, which is on top, of course, of you pay for your internet access, whether it's cell, whether it's broadband, dial-up, whatever, right? So that is the value exchange. Of course, Facebook takes that, goes out to raise billions of dollars, But that is also a market pricing exchange. You get this service, this tool from Facebook in exchange for your time. So it's not always about the money. Okay, so these elements come together in a model called relational model typology. And it was identified by Alan Page Fisk, professor at UCLA. And to quote Dr. Fisk, people use just four fundamental models for organizing most aspects of sociality in almost all cultures all the time, right? So the reason we connect, the reason we're social, the reason we understand each other is based on these models. As we discussed, communal sharing, like Wikipedia, equality matching, like a blog roll, like Ray's scratch your back, you scratch my back, I scratch yours, and market pricing, like Facebook or like Hugh Grant. But that's just three, right? Someone said that's just three. Of course it is. So let me talk about the fourth. So I live in Austin now. I've lived here for almost 2 years, but I lived in Boston for 10 years before that. So it's very difficult for me to actually show a full screen picture of this person. But this is a picture I took at Fenway Park, when I was there for a Red Sox game. And of course, these are the Yankees taking batting practice on the field. And that guy standing there, anybody know who that is? That's right, Alex Rodriguez, who's the highest paid player in professional baseball today. I believe his average contract value per year is $32 million. $32 million, right? $32 million for a guy that, I mean, he, you know, fields the ball, hits it, chokes every now and then, you know, in the postseason. But, you know, that's A-Rod, highest paid player in baseball. But I got to tell you, it wasn't always like that, right? Baseball salaries weren't crazy. So free agency happened in the early to mid 1970s. And after in the what is generally called the era of free agency. And if you look at salaries and the way they increased over time, starting in 1970 and then in the mid 70s where free agency took hold, that's when things started to skyrocket, right? Average salaries, of course, might be 3 million, but you've got your Alex Rodriguez, Manny Ramirez, and other high-paid players. And then the minimum salary, the floor, also rose, right? So baseball salaries were up 6,600% due to free agency. But it wasn't always like this, actually. So back in the day, a guy like Stan Musial, okay, Hall of Famer, one of the best, no doubt, to ever play the game. End of the 1957 season. And this is so inspiration taken from Gladwell in an article he wrote in The New Yorker. You know, Musial has a pretty awful season, actually, by his standards. Goes to his coach, manager at the end of the season, says, "You know what? Come back next season. I should get a 20% pay cut." It's like, why is that? It's like, I didn't have the season that was expected of me this year, so I don't deserve the money. You know, and this dude's in the Hall of Fame and making nowhere near even that. 3 million average today, right? But that's how it worked back then, back in free agency, before free agency. Now, to understand that, you have to understand the story of this guy, Marvin Miller. Marvin Miller grew up in lower Manhattan, and he was the son of a factory worker. And he was exposed to the ways that that the U.S. started to unionize back in the day. And so as he grew up, went through his career, he was an attorney, a labor lawyer, eventually signed on with MLBPA, or Major League Baseball Players Association, and came to represent them and showed them how they were being patronized and really underpaid for what they're worth by owners and by teams. So over time, as he was able to unionize players and show them what was going on with regard to their talent versus owners and the way capital was managing them, he was able to bring about an era of free agency. So along this same chart where Marvin Miller was union lead at MLBPA, you can see that average salaries when he started in 66 was $19,000. In 1982, when Miller retired, $241,000. And I'm no mathematician or economist, but I can tell you that even if you adjust for inflation, and everything in between, that's not the same, right? That is a massive increase in money. And of course, you know what happened after that. You ended up with highly inflated, overpaid players like Alex Rodriguez, Jack. So Average player salaries rose, and Marvin Miller, what happened was the idea of authority ranking, which is our fourth element in Fisk's model, right? In authority ranking, you've got a linear hierarchy where subordinates defer and superiors take a pastoral responsibility for their players. See, because like in Major League Baseball, in the Mutual days and before then, you would have managers who would do things like, pay for a player's sick kid hospital visit, or it's your anniversary. Here, let me give you a 20. Take your wife out and get her something special. You know, so they would give players these favors, right? So this pastoral, paternalistic management style. So what this represents, if you'll bear with me with one more sports analogy, it was a shift. What Marvin Miller helped to drive was a shift of power from capital, so owners and people who ran the system, to talent, the players who made it all worthwhile. And in football, you can use the analogy of like a Jerry Jones at the Dallas Cowboys and a massively talented player like Tom Brady, right? Move from capital to talent. And now people like Tom can get what they're worth. Now in the NFL season was almost lost not too long ago. And if you remember some of the language that was used, if you're an NBA fan, the language that was used before the season, in the beginning, media starts calling this thing a strike. Well, the players are on strike. The players refuse to play. Are you kidding me? They make $20 million, $30 million a year. How could you strike? Just go play the kids' game, right, and go get some money. The players change the rules. They change the language, start calling it a lockout. The owners are not letting us play. The owners are preventing us from getting on the field. They're shifting the conversation from being talent's fault to capital. Big, bad, evil capital is locking us out, not letting us play, and changes public sentiment about the whole situation. And then the players get paid more. Now, some might argue that it's a bit extreme these days with $32 million, $25 million, et cetera, but that is how we resolve that remains to be seen. Okay, think about this in a business sense, right? Because we all work, right? Or we all want to get paid. Average executive pay in the U.S., pay of CEOs, graph from The Economist. For the most part, in the 20th century, CEO pay was flat. It's kind of hard to believe, right? You look at this graph in the 30s, charting it in 36, we go through wartime, World War II, pretty flat for almost the entire 20th century, right? But do you see, remember what we talked about, the era of free agency when it came to Major League Baseball? There was a cultural shift happening around that time. And you see, right about that same time in this CEO graph pay, that line starts to go up. And of course, it goes up dramatically from there. The mean goes up crazy amounts in the dot-com era, right, with stock and dot-com and salaries going crazy. But it was the same thing happening that you could see in sports, in CEO pay, and in business. Pay moving from the corporation, from the DuPonts, the Kodaks, the JP Morgans of the world, into the hands of superstar CEOs and CMOs. So instead of General Electric, it was Jack Welch at General Electric. Instead of, Chainsaw Al, right, at Sunbeam. So these superstar, rockstar CEOs. I wonder if we'll feel the same about Mitt Romney, depending on how far he goes. So we'll see. So one question I'll ask is does authority ranking apply to you? So think about your job. And I want to tell you a story about a place I used to work, actually, which was Forrester Research. You remember the definition of authority ranking, right? Linear, hierarchical relationship. Superiors, pastoral responsibility for subordinates. So every year, around Christmas time, the CEO of Forrester, whose name was George Colony, and by the way, his middle name is Forrester, so he's GFC, George Forrester Colony, his name is on the company, would walk around the office in Cambridge, which is where the headquarters is, and every year he would have two things. He'd have an assistant to follow because he's passed these things out. One was a gift, something tangible, actually like this umbrella. This is a Forrester umbrella I got one year around Christmas. Another year it was a fleece, a green vest, if the Forrester official corporate color is green. Another year it was a backpack with a logo. And he would also hand out a $100 bill, crisp, clean, in its own Citizens Bank envelope, and every person, he would walk up to every employee who was there and say thank you, hand them their umbrella, vest, backpack, and $100 bill. It was his way of saying thank you. Now, pretty nice gesture in a lot of ways. Don't get me wrong. I have an umbrella. I've been dry all day, right, walking around Austin. And a $100 bill, cash money in your pocket, is not a bad thing to have. But think about that authority ranking, right? The pastoral responsibility, the days of baseball owners slipping you a 20 to do something nice for your family because I'm taking care of you, little one that's in my flock. Does authority ranking apply to where you are today? For those of you who I work with, don't answer that. Think about it. So authority ranking explains the rise of social media. We're so excited to talk about how news breaks on Twitter. So, Whitney Houston, 27 minutes before mainstream media talked about it. Or Osama bin Laden is dead. It was on Twitter first. And even before that, it was the guy, you know, it's like there's bombs exploding in the middle of the night in Afghanistan. This is atypical. It was on Twitter first. Or even, if you know about India, Mr. Banchan, who played the game show host on Slumdog Millionaire, super famous Bollywood star. He has super famous son and daughter who had a grandkid. This was like the most heralded baby ever in the history of Twitter because it was India and Banchan and Bollywood stars going crazy about this birth. We herald the news breaking on Twitter. If you think about it from authority ranking, because this upsets the balance, mainstream media to social media, right? We're changing the means of production. It's not CNN or the New York Times or the Washington Post telling us what's happening. The power is back into our hands. We've shifted capital to talent, and we're the talent. So that's why this works. So let's talk about applying RMT or relational model topology to social business, right? Because here's how we make it work. But I have to be honest, I can't go there quite yet. Because it sounds pretty good, but there's absolutely a downside to making this stuff work. So let's start by talking about communal sharing, right? If you've been to Amsterdam or are familiar with Amsterdam, huge bicycle culture. This is a bicycle parking lot that is next to the main train station in Amsterdam, right? And in Amsterdam, huge culture where people, you know, bike everywhere. Most people have their own bike. And it was back in the mid-20th century where the first bike sharing program got started. So there was a guy, a little bit of a rebel, who took a handful of bicycles, painted them white. And if you're in Austin, you know what a white-painted bicycle means, so a little bit different back then, and placed them in points around the city and spreads the word. These are for sharing. So get a bike, ride it somewhere, leave it, someone else takes it, and the love spreads around the city, right? Pretty decent concept. But if you know Amsterdam, what happened was that the majority of the bikes, after a couple weeks, ended up in the canals or basically stolen, repainted, and so people had a free bike, right? So it was the breakdown of communal sharing. As we're in social media, as we're in social business, some of you may know the story of Jonathan's card. Any Starbucks fans out there with the Starbucks app on your iPhone? Yeah? Yeah? So Jonathan's card, Jonathan, who's a software developer, realized that he could take a picture of his Starbucks card, just put it online, and you could use it anywhere. So he posts the picture. He's like, hey, you know those give a penny, take a penny jars you find at the counter sometimes? Well, I'm going to do that with the Starbucks card. So here, look, here's my card. There's money on it. Save this picture to your phone. Take it in, and it can be scanned. Buy yourself a coffee. Buy yourself a latte. And, you know, if you feel like it, put some more money on it. Give a penny, take a penny. You know, and people were first skeptical, you know, but then reports started flying in. Dude, it works. There was actually money. I got a coffee from using this card. And users started participating. Up, down. Starbucks was aware of this. They were nervous about what might happen, but they let it go. They wanted to see what was going to happen. And so the story starts hitting mainstream media until there's a tragedy of the commons. So there's a guy, Sam Odio, another developer, who says, hey, I figured out a way to use Jonathan's card and buy myself an iPad. Because he wrote himself a script to monitor the balance of Jonathan's card. And whenever it got to a certain point, his script ran, pulled the money back to his own Starbucks card, because you can transfer value between these two things, and then withdrew and put it into his PayPal account, and then just sat there and waited until Jonathan's card got reloaded. Starbucks caught wind of this, and they shut it down. Said, okay, this puts it over the line. It gets too close to fraud in terms of what's going on. People are outraged. Odeo says, oh no, I'm just kidding. I'm gonna donate all this money to charity. No, I just wanted to show you what was possible potentially, you know, with the card. I'm just trying to point out the flaws of the system. But it was seen, as good as communal sharing seems in theory, in practice, these kind of things happen, right? Tragedy of the commons. All right. So I assume is anybody not on Twitter in here? Not a Twitter? You can raise your hand. We're among friends. You're not on Twitter. Why not? I didn't say I wasn't going to make fun of you, but you know. So twitter.com, sign up. They're having a party at Art House Monday night. You should go and hang out. And maybe they can convince you to get on Twitter, OK? Art House, it's at 6th and Congress, or 7th and Congress. 7th and Congress. It's a great place. We had our party there last year. So do you follow back? When you get a follow and you get a notification, do you follow back? No, mostly not. Sometimes. Do you ever feel a little bit guilty though, you know? Like you get followed and it's like, maybe I should follow back. Maybe not. Yeah, because this is a quality matching, right? Remember, I scratch your back, you scratch mine. So I want to point out some users. Jason Calcanis pretty much follows everybody back. You know, at one time, actually, Twitter had a feature where you could email support and they would just turn on auto-follow. But they turned it off at a certain point. And so now, that's why a person like Calcanis, even though he tries to follow everybody back. Social mention? Do you work at Social Mention? Okay. Got it. So you can use Social Mention now. They used to have a native service, but they turned it out, so you need to use a third-party service. If you want to feel good, if you want to get followed back, go follow Jason Calcanis, right? He'll follow you back. It makes people feel good, right? So there's Calcanis, and then there's Kawasaki. You know, about 50-50, right? Kawasaki does a pretty good job, but, you know, he's got about 300,000 followers to catch up on in terms of making that equivalent. Then you got accounts like the NBA, right, who's like wildly out of balance, like 4.2 million followers to 966. So the question is, how do you start to apply this idea of equality matching, and how do you feel about it in your behavior and in your brand's approach to the market? Market pricing. If you are a homeowner and you've been assessed or you know about real estate taxes, it's your house and your land. And you know that there's a huge problem if you were a homeowner in 2006 to 2008, as the real estate market crashes and suddenly the market decides that housing land just ain't worth what they used to be. But the problem is that banks still want the exact same amount of money that you signed up to pay them, right? So there's a problem in market pricing when the market or the public starts to disagree on the standards. Right, on Hugh Grant's $60, maybe that was worth $200, maybe it's worth $20. So market prices can fluctuate, and it's a problem if they fluctuate very quickly. For example, this is a picture from Ireland, and if you know about the economies in Ireland, Greece, and Iceland, these conditions changed very fast and created a lot of difficulty in those countries. Authority ranking. So rather than Occupy Wall Street, you're in Austin now. This is our own version. I don't even know if they use this hashtag, but this happened outside of my office one day, right? I work in the Bank of America building at 6th and Congress, and there's a protest outside. So did they ever use anything like, you know, Occupy City Hall or Occupy 6th Street? Well, anyways, occupying 6th Street. You know, aside from a lot of these people who, as reported in the Statesman, turn out to be homeless people who are, you know, just along for the ride, the fundamentals of what's going on here is authority ranking. And authority ranking explains the tension that's here in the system, the tension of capital in institutions like banks, like government, like churches, like employers, to talent, to the workers, to the people providing the value. And that's really what's at the core. While I personally don't have very little interest in Occupy Wall Street, it's fascinating to me from an authority ranking perspective and where we might end up. Because this is a fundamental part of how we socialize and how we define ourselves vis-a-vis society. So even if you don't care either, think about what it means from a relational, society's relational standpoint. Okay, so let's take a trip to Mars. We've talked about some of the good, some of the bad, and this is gonna be a picture from my company. I would say the ugly, but that would be insulting. So let's take a trip to Mars and let's go visit a dinner party, okay? So over at Whole Foods, you can go on a team bonding exercise and cook dinner with each other and then serve it to one another and eat it. And I wanna outline this model for you, where when you go and have a meal, and have a dinner party, let's say, that's market pricing. So you go to Whole Foods, do you want to pay for organic or not? For for local or for national? So market pricing comes into play because different foods and different ingredients have different prices, but you select what you're going to eat and what you're going to serve. The A comes into play with authority ranking. Where do you sit? Who decides? At this table, actually, our CFO is at the end of the table. The most senior person in the room right there, right? So if you're familiar with Japanese corporate culture as well, right, the most senior person sits next to the window and you descend in hierarchical ranking as you get to the end of that table. So authority ranking, think about how that works. Or if you host a dinner party, you decide where people sit. So the R, M-A-R, is reciprocal invitations. That's equality matching. In this case, it's a little bit different, but think about the last time you hosted, you had people over. Or you went to a party, more often around Christmas time. There's someone in our office who's planning her wedding, and she's having the damnedest time trying to figure out how to not have 15 bridesmaids. Because it's a combination of, well, I was in her wedding, so I have to get her back, and is she gonna be mad? That's equality matching, right? How do you bring this together? Or should we invite the Hirschfelds over because they have a kick-ass Christmas party and we want to be on that list? So let's invite them over to our spring fling, right? So that's the R, and then self-service. So in this case, communal sharing. It's just not right. Although some people do it, you may work with a person like this, but you've got food out and no one takes all the food that's in the plate. You leave a little bit for somebody else, right? But of course, some of us are a little bit less cultured than others, and it tends to happen. The self-service doesn't always work. But think about that principle. So we're going to take a trip to Mars and look at this in a business context. So meal selection, you choose the dishes, which have different costs. That's like content selection. You choose the topics and what's going to appeal to people. So three different appeals within market pricing. So here's a framework to think about. Three basic elements. Fun stuff. So is your content there to excite, to engage, to entertain? There's an example where KLM was launching new service from Amsterdam to Miami, new nonstop flight. They announce it, they say, hey, sign up, coming in 2 months. And they get a tweet. This guy comes back to them and says, hey, there's a huge music festival, winter music festival happened in Miami. I'd love to go there with my friends. So if you could just move the flight up 3 weeks, that would be great. Are you kidding me? I've never worked for an airline, but I've flown a lot of airlines. It's like, yeah, right. And they said, you know what? If you can fill an entire plane, we'll move up the schedule and start flying early. And as you can tell, they did it. They filled the plane. They had DJs. They had a party. They won a couple Guinness World Records for the highest altitude dance party. And they listened, responded. And that's one way of thinking how to engage with your customers, right? Fun stuff. Second element, rewarding stuff. So show me the money. Show me the money. This is Michelle Phan. She is in her early 20s. And what she used to do she was an art student. And she was a sushi waitress. And what she would do would be to take her MacBook Pro and shoot videos of herself putting on makeup. And she would do things, as you can guess, that I am a very... very adept makeup artist myself. She would do things like create the smoky eyes look. Yeah, that's right. I know smoky eyes. Or what's that? Yes. So right. The screen grab I got was she was doing Angelina Jolie's The Tourist look, which if you caught Ricky Gervais and Johnny Depp admitting he's never even seen The Tourist. That's how poor of a movie it was. But, you know, great cinematography. So Angelina Jolie's The Tourist. And Fan gets discovered by Lancome and gets paid. Right, she is the official video makeup artist, online video makeup artist now for Lancome. Discovered and is rewarded. Fun stuff, rewarding stuff, and emotional stuff. So this is also Bastrop out there in the woods. And last summer, I don't know about, so it's last summer, we had a record heat in Austin. We had 86 days over 100 last summer. It was a record, as you can imagine. And dude, it was freaking hot here, right? I lived in Boston before, and it was pretty god-awful. Our air conditioner even broke at one point, and that's like the last thing you want. But there were wildfires that caught on near the end of the summer out in Bastrop. I believe it was about 35,000 acres that were burned. There were about 3,500 or 4,000 homes that were just totally destroyed, like the one over there. It actually happened over, it was Labor Day weekend, right? And so there was the problem was compounded by the fact that a lot of people were just away. So they couldn't do things like grab their grandmother's jewelry or their important documents because they were like in, you know, in Disneyland or at Lost Pines hanging out in the Lazy River. So what happens is that high at Lost Pines, their Facebook page starts to become a hub for local response because you can go and see the posts where they're talking about come and hang out and ride a longhorn. And then as this crisis starts to take shape and people realize what's going on, it becomes a hub for communication. Guests who have stayed there, hey, you know, I'm back in Chicago, but we had an awesome vacation. Is Jose, you know, from the bar, is he okay? Because most of the people who work there live in the area. And then they start taking donations from other Hyatts, from past guests, to help families rebuild. Right, so really getting at something emotional and something that meant something to their employees and past guests. So fun stuff, rewarding stuff, emotional stuff, when we're thinking about market pricing, how to connect. All right, equality matching, who to invite, and on social networks, who do you connect with? What do you want to get out of that? A very simple example, on Facebook and timelines, it's as simple as a connection. Because when we put up a timeline, there's a commitment to make a connection with the brand, and brands have a commitment to respond. So equality matching. You put up content, I'm going to respond to you and reciprocate. All right, communal sharing. So self-service, but leave some for others, right? Don't take all the Brussels sprouts. The way you see this online is advocacy, and users starting to help one another. So for example, peer-to-peer advice in sharing forums. Think about South by Southwest, two things happen every year, right? Daylight savings time switches, which is Sunday morning, 2 a.m. Don't forget, everyone's always late to the Sunday morning panels because they're hungover too. And taxes, right? It means that tax deadline is about a month away. So TurboTax has a service called Live Community in their online forum. And if you use TurboTax, like I do, you know that you can ask a question about anything in Live Community. For example, someone filing their taxes may have a question about, well, can I deduct the amount of my monthly employee parking fee? And you'll have other users respond, you know, well, IRS code says this, and I've got this advice, here's a link to, you know, as citation for it, et cetera. You made out well, it's already in your W-2. So users helping others, right? Communal sharing of a resource. Of course, paid for by Intuit and TurboTax, but then users creating content and contributing to one another. All right, last element, authority ranking. So we talked about how at a dinner party, it's arranged seating. And in social media, social business, this is probably the most important one. It's the path to monetization, which you as a brand owner decide. So it's not like this, right? This is authority ranking gone wrong. So in the mid-2000s, GM's Chevy brand advertises on, goes on The Apprentice, the old Donald Trump show, right? And wants to push the Chevy Tahoe and says, you know what, we got a great idea. We're gonna put all different elements online, we're gonna put visuals, music, and you're gonna be able to overlay text. We're gonna have people create their own commercials. Awesome, right? And then stuff like this comes out. Don't buy me, my MPG sucks. No blood for oil in Iraq. And GM's like, oh, shit. You know, why did we do this, right? Because there were no controls on this campaign. authority ranking gone wrong, no parameters too much given from the capital to the talent. Now, an example of this gone right, you may not love these commercials, but in a much better defined path to monetization is Doritos with role sorting for consumers, right? Crash the Super Bowl, they've done it a few years in a row. If you remember, I think this was the winner, right? The flying baby with the Dorito grabs it, you know, and comes back. So consumer generated, whether or not, you know, this the winner is semi-pro, as often is the case or not, sharing from capital to talent. So brands defining how consumers play with them, not against them. Okay, RMT in action. Let me walk you through some brand examples of putting this all together. So Levi's. Levi's is a brand that my company has worked with. They were launching a new brand of jeans called Waterless. Real problem, a lot of water goes into the manufacture of a pair of jeans. And they had a new model out and a new style, a new SKU, and they wanted to highlight the fact that it used less water. And so to help the launch of this, they create an integrated social media campaign. So it's the Water Tank Challenge. So there's a donation in kind. You participate in these activities. We're making a 200 million liter donation to water.org. You participate and create these activities, whether it's check-ins, tweets, answering Yahoo Q&A, and in turn, we'll help publicize that. So market pricing, you give us the labor, we'll help make you famous in there and help people know you're doing a good thing. In terms of results, these are the stats, these are the views, but probably the most important, I can't give you too much detail because that is client confidential, they're able to stop the ad buy that they had on Facebook because they had so much take up for this campaign. And what that demonstrates, it's not just cool in terms of the success, but the business purpose was, of course, launching the product, driving attention, and so good that they were able to save money along the way, the path to monetization. And finally, the communal sharing, the participation, the experience of all the people who helped unlock the 200 million liters of water and help Levi's save some money on an ad buy. Another example, Red Bull. So Red Bull launched a campaign called Stash. And using game mechanics, it would use Facebook as a backbone. What they did was hide energy shots on college campuses around the country. So they were, Red Bull was one of the original energy drinks, and they were getting their asses kicked by 5-Hour Energy. New entrant to the market, they never saw it coming. We got to fight back. So they created energy shots. They get their wings team, their college campus team activated, hides these energy shots on college campuses and parks and venues around the country. Using Facebook as a backbone, here's how you play the game, and they geotagged places where they were hiding these stashes. This is the CRM backbone to the game, essentially. And what people would do was take clues and then go find. It was a little bit of it's geocaching and a game to go out and physically find these stashes. And when people found stashes, they would do things like take pictures of themselves, upload it to Facebook, and be jubilant about doing so. And of course, the more stashes you found, there's a grand prize winner at the end. The thing was, people were investing their time in playing this game, going out and finding stashes. So that's market pricing. Because, it's great to have free product, but think about the difference in terms of product sampling and an approach where you get people engaged and willing to spend hours on end. We actually relaunched Stash, and the winner was telling us, told about his process. I think he spent about 48 hours almost straight. He slept very little in pursuit of these clues. So you get some energy shots, and for this round, you won a trip to New York for the World Breakdancing Championships. That's not even that cool of a prize, right? But it's about the journey along the way, the market pricing. Of course, there are prizes for winners, authority ranking determined by the company, a quality matching. In any game, there's turn taking, right? We place stashes, you go find them, and we move from one round to two to three. And finally, communal sharing. So people participating, sharing in the experience, talking to one another about the stashes they found, and participating in the hunt. All right, one last example from Nestle. Now, thing about Nestle and the thing about advocacy in general is that every brand has a group of passionate fans, right? Every brand. even if you sell ball bearings, trust me, you've got a group of passionate automotive fans out there who need your ball bearings. So how do you find them and activate them? Because we're not all like Apple, right? We don't have people lining up around the magic cube to get our stuff. And in particular, what happens if you're Coffee Mate, for example, right? The thing is, every brand has advocates. Not exactly the new iPad, but we launched a program called the Brew Crew. And the Brew Crew is a group of individuals who are passionate Coffee Mate loyalists. And they have volunteered to host parties in their apartments, their houses, and to bring people in and try different flavors of Coffee Mate. You guys are thinking, what the hell are you talking about, man? Coffee Mate parties? Like it's like a flight of bourbon, maybe, or beer? No, this is Coffee Mate we're talking about, right? So the Brew Crew has 65,000 people waiting to get in. That's no joke. 65,000 people want to be in the Brew Crew. So what they do is they have events. So applications to sign up, we synchronize the events, 4,500 Brew Crew events, tasting events, 50,000 attendees overall. And so what this did for Nestle, there's time and effort to host, right? Market pricing. We're going to apply for the Brew Crew, get the samples, invite people to our home, and that effort is the market price for me to be seen as an influencer to my friends and input to Coffee Mate. There's part, who do I invite? Pretty straightforward, like we talked about. Who comes to my Brew Crew event? I share the product in my home, in the sampling party, and the bottom line is ROI, right? Authority ranking for Nestle and for Coffee Mate. This program in particular, 11 times return on investment for what they paid for the program. All right, so in closing, social was social before marketers got interested, right? Before any of us came to South By to talk about Twitter, Foursquare, Gowalla, Highlight, you name it, RMT, relational model typology, explains why we socialize. So when you put it together, when you're designing campaigns, it's a matter of balancing power between capital and talent. So take a trip to Mars, see how the model fits into what you're planning. And as you go away this weekend, as you're out of the office, as you're hanging out, making connections, think about authority ranking, how it's in play at your current job, and if it makes you happy when you think about what's going on. All right, so one last shameless plug for the book, publishes May 1st. It's actually very little about this presentation, but dach.is, sbdbook.com. And if you were mildly entertained by this session, I assure you, you'll love one of these. My colleague Dave Gray, who's going to be here on Sunday talking about the Connected Company, it's going to be a panel. Jen Vandermeer, who's going to be talking about brands and advocacy and Intercontinental. And my buddy Jack on Monday, Secrets of User-Centric Social Experience. With that, thanks, and I'll take any questions that you might have. I know it's a tough thing to, come up with questions on. Like, is it? What if I don't? What if I'm antisocial? What if I'm like the Unabomber? Yes. No, not at all. So how does entertainment play into this? And the experience in many parts is, it's the old saying goes, it's not just the destination, it's the journey that gets you there, right, along the way. So absolutely. And some of the best experiences, if you think about like a Nike Plus, right, for example, or some of the, some of these track as you go activities, it's the experience is all about how you get there along the way. So one would argue that designing that complete user experience is key to making any of this work, actually, and not just if it's too, consumer, we're smart, right? It's like if we know when it's just about selling the pants or getting the product. And in some ways, like Fox Mulder, we want to believe, right? We want to believe that, the truth is out there and we know we're being conned, but we're going to enjoy it along the way, right? And if it's not there, then we opt out. We decide that market pricing is not acceptable to us. or the equality matching is not there, and so consumers will opt out. And that's why it's so important to find the balance between capital and talent. Awesome. So 6 o'clock, we've got happy hours to go to, so thank you so much for sharing. Have a great South by.